Hey everyone, it's Travis.
And I'm Ryan.
And thanks for listening as we catch up with you this week. We've had a fairly laid back week. I don't know about you.
Mine's been pretty chill.
Yeah, since the last time we were able to sit down and kind of chat, I mean, not much has happened. No prophecies have been made. No one stormed anything.
All the prophecies that are out there have turned out to be false.
That's so. Right. All the prophecies so far are continuing to be highly inaccurate. I mean, granted, March 4th isn't here yet, so anything could still happen. I believe that is our next major deadline is March 4th. But then,
what is the March 4th deadline?
The March 4th is
I'm learning more about constitutional process.
The prophecies that all declared that. That Trump was going to remain president when the inauguration happened and there wasn't a military coup and the angels of Belize or wherever didn't show up to rescue him. There's some dialing back of like almost like you remember like years ago when they used to reinterpret the Bible code, right? Like someone would be like, "This is the end because here's the Bible code that tells us that when you combine this scripture with this word, with this number, with this whatever, it all points to this date." And then they would be like, "Oh, I added instead of subtracted, and so I need to reassess my date.
I feel like
my doom date.
I feel like whoever did this was not reading their secret decoder ring right."
Exactly. So there's been several of the prophets, quote unquote. I use that term incredibly loosely. Or at least the followers of the prophecies about this presidential stuff who are like, "Oh, no, it's a recalibration. They just simply had some timing inconsistencies, and they're all convinced that March 4th is going to come, and that's when Trump will emerge out of Mar-a-Lago, golf club in hand, and resume the presidency."
Because he has the constitutional right to do that?
Because God has ordained it. Who needs the Constitution when God has chosen?
That's right. I forgot.
You gotta remember.
I forget.
You're playing with the big man now.
This is God's chosen.
The big man upstairs is the one who's foreordaining all this.
He is not bound by constitutions.
And he's not bound by constitutions, even for America, his favorite country.
Obviously. Because we are the new Israel. Because we are.
I feel dirty just saying this stuff.
We are the chosen race. The royal priesthood.
I feel like the ground's going to open up and just consume us whole. Oh my God. That's the thing.
I feel awful
saying this, and I'm not the one actually making these nonsense prophecies. How do these people do this without any sense of guilt and shame?
They have no conscience.
My God.
And maybe that's what the African angels were saying. Paula White is calling out to them. And they'd be like, "I thought you were the chosen nation."
Listen, if you have no idea what we're talking about, feel free to go back, skip, just go ahead and put us on pause right now. Go back, roll up some of the previous episodes from last season as we got towards the end of last year, and that will catch you up, and you'll understand what the angels are from Africa are doing, and you'll understand why there's prophecy nonsense, and you'll catch up. So, because I understand. If you're coming in cold, this is a confusing thing, and we're only 3 minutes in.
It's become an inside joke in our family. I'll hear Shepard and Rex, who are 10 and 8, upstairs going, "Angels from Africa.
Angels from Africa." Oh, my goodness. But anywho, all that to say, March 4th is still coming, so, you know, I suppose we still have to wait and see a little bit. I don't know what happens once March 4th comes, nothing happens, and do they just re-rig? Who was that guy? Remember the guy? It was some old codger. Some old codger on the radio who was constantly predicting the end of the world via his numerology, Bible nonsense. And every year or so, he would make his, "Here's when the doom is coming." And then every year it would miss it. And he would, that's what I'm saying. He'd go back and reassess and he'd be like, "Oh, I got this wrong and I misunderstood this." And
my bad.
And yeah, and so he'd just simply knock it out like another 6 to 9 months. So I don't know. Maybe that's what they'll do is maybe they'll just keep going. Maybe they'll just keep pushing it back for the next 4 years until the next election. And then they'll be like, "This was the election."
And he'll be like the phoenix rising from the ashes.
Didn't
somebody say one time, "Beware the Ides of March"?
They did.
Isn't that like March 4th?
Maybe that was that prophetic? It might have been prophetic. Who knew? Mm-hmm. Anyway,
I think it was Shakespeare.
It's been a relatively quiet week. I am interested in a couple of things from you. I want to know what your thoughts are. Number one, I do want to know, since again, we usually tend to look at Twitter as a form of light entertainment. Twitter used to be a great social media thing, but now it's basically VH1 for social media. It is the MTV. It runs nothing but like 16-year-old pregnancy television shows and ridiculousness. And that's pretty much all it's good for.
Yeah.
Is just utter nonsense. So I have not heard, maybe you have, because I'll be honest, haven't had a chance to really get on to my soap opera of Twitter.
That's what I'm here for.
Is Kenny Copeland, is he going to get the vaccine? Does he take the vaccine? Do you need to take the vaccine once you've blown the hot winds of God over COVID and burned it out of the atmosphere? Or do you rush to be first in line? Because here's the thing. O.J. Simpson got the vaccine 2 weeks ago. O.J. Simpson has a vaccine. I'm just right now, I'm kind of compiling my list of ridiculous people who have somehow managed to get this thing, while other people who actually are more deserving and more essential have not yet gotten it. And so I'm just kind of wondering, like what's your guesstimate? Where do you think Paula White and Kevin Copeland and these guys all fit onto the will they get it? And if so, do they deserve?
I'm going to say that they probably won't get it.
Okay. I mean, does it destroy their credibility if they do?
I think it does. I mean, I think it destroys the mighty breath of God that comes from Kenneth Copeland's mouth.
The hot winds.
The hot winds of favor and the hot winds of divine intervention. So I would say that, you know, it could put a little... But here's the thing. Let me backtrack a little bit.
Okay.
Did they have any credibility to begin with?
No.
I mean, when you're calling down African angels and you're also breathing during a pandemic when everybody says, please don't breathe on people, and you're breathing on, you know, live television during a pandemic.
Dear God.
I don't think and you also have crazy eyes. Well, Kenneth Copeland has some crazy
He does. And I guess the reason why I ask is because one of the last things I do remember, I looked this up earlier, I'm just double-checking it to make sure that I'm in the right spot, and I am, is the Copelands were the ones who basically made it very clear that you don't need flu shots, measles shots, any vaccinations as long as you've got Jesus.
Because you plead the blood.
Yeah, basically, yes. It's one of those things where, you know, once you live in that divine health, that stuff just can't touch you unless you're living in some form of hidden, secret, unknown sin or open rebellion to probably Kenneth Copeland, because then that can, of course, open the door to the devil who can then get you with the flu. But in general... the Copeland stance has been for several years. Like, this is not new to COVID. This is, this has been kind of his stance for at least the past 10 years. Because I remember in the late 2000s, early 2010s, he was going on about why you don't need measles vaccines. Because vaccines are unnecessary for Christians because of divine health.
Because by his wounds we are healed.
That's what he says. And it's just one of those things where I sit there going, so if you're Kenneth Copeland, and we know Kenneth Copeland's up in his 70s.
Who knows
how old. Or maybe even older, but I know he's got to be at least in his
70s. I mean, he's looking very crypt keeperish.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, it's like
almost twins.
I'm just kind of curious to know, like, if the vaccine becomes available, does Kenneth Copeland get it? Does he get it secretly? I don't know. I'm just speculating at this point. It's one of those slight things. If you ever wonder what keeps me up at night, these are the kind of things that keep me up at night. Like, did Kenneth Copeland get a vaccine? I don't know. It's trivial, but it nags at my brain.
All right, here's my prediction. I'm going to call it a prediction, not a prophecy, because I don't want to get stoned for being wrong.
Join the club. They know. They apparently never do.
I did see one guy.
We are very lax in our stoning.
I did see one guy that was willing to submit to the Deuteronomy stoning.
I did see that. Now, granted, I don't know that he followed up on it. I did make.
He was willing to submit because somebody said, "Are you willing to submit to Deuteronomy?" You know, I think it's 4 or whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah.
And he said yes.
Yes.
He was
that.
He was prophesying that, you know, President Trump would be president.
See,
still.
This is another guy that I have to go catch up on. And be like, boy, did you get your stoning?
Did you get
your vaccine or did you get your stoning? I'm just kind of. I'm actually happy if you pick one or the other.
So my prediction is that Kenneth Copeland will not, but Paula White will, and okay. she'll do it in secret. And she'll still say, I plead the blood of Jesus.
Yeah, yeah.
Or she'll say, like, an African angel came to me in a dream and told me to get the vaccine because it is safe and it's not the mark of the beast.
Ah, I could see that. I could see it also being one of those things of, I don't need it, but I'm around sinners who might. And so I get it in order to protect fallen around me.
She's probably not.
That would definitely feed into
the status of Kenneth Copeland, because Kenneth Copeland has his own private jet. So.
Oh dear goodness, it's a good point.
So Kenneth Copeland is not around sinners because he's got his own private jet, and him and Creflo Dollar probably, you know, have their jets parked next to each other.
It's possible that this will not be the most uplifting episode that we've ever done. This may not be the friendliest, most gracious, positive affirming
what?
Thing.
But just being
that brings real. Me to my actual thought that I wanted to throw out there. This was something a friend of mine and I were discussing earlier this week. He threw it out there. I believe he's discussing it on his podcast, but it got me kind of thinking because of the fact there were so many different responses in the thread. When it comes to people who are maybe living with some nonsense, there's a classic phrase. Been thrown around evangelical churches for years, kind of to distill the great truths of all of the gospel into one easy to ascertain, easy to chew kind of sentence, which is, love the sinner.
Hate the sin. Yes.
What do you think of that?
Well, I think if you take it for what it is, just on the surface, It's not a bad comment. It's not a bad idea to follow because yes, you want the only problem is like you're labeling somebody a sinner, which we're all sinners,
and you're engaging in the dark side.
Yes,
which is powerful.
Yes,
make you a great Sith, but you know
it does make you a great
let
Sith.
Let the hate flow through you.
But the hate the sin part, I do see the original intent behind that is to, yes, God hates sin, therefore we should hate sin, and we should not embrace the sin. The problem with it is Christians have blurred the lines.
Yeah.
And almost made it to change that saying to say, hate the sinner and the sin.
Yeah.
And well, that's how we treat people. We treat them as though, you know, I hate you because you are this. And I tell people at our church all the time, it's like, we have to stop labeling people. We have to stop labeling them as, like a homosexual and a transgender and an alcoholic and a drug addict. And that's how we do things. We label them as these different things. And we have to stop doing that. We just see them as people who are broken, who need hope in Jesus. And if we, continue on that path of just labeling people, you know, I was watching some video today, some clip today of, and if you're a political person, maybe you've heard of this whole Marjorie Taylor Greene thing. Whew, she's, wow. But anyway, that's a whole nother podcast talking about her. But there was a video of her saying, you know, she's taking the video herself and she's going to go to Representative, I can't remember her name. I think her first name is like... Who's the Muslim senator? Do you know who I'm talking about?
Oh, yes. Now that you said that, I've lost her name. I know.
And again, I'm talking about labeling people, and that's how I label her. But anyway, she's got sworn in on the Quran because she is
Islamic.
The
name is just evading me all of a sudden.
Marjorie Taylor Greene is like videoing herself, gonna go walk. She's like, we're gonna go to her office, you know, and say she has to swear on the Bible because it's not real, because you swore on the Quran, and so you gotta swear on the Bible because that's what we're supposed to do. And I'm watching this going, why are we using the Bible as a weapon? And that's my issue today. Like, we use scripture, we use God, we use our beliefs as weapons to wage war against people. You swore in the Quran.
It's Ilhan Omar. That's what it is.
Yeah. So there, she was going to go to Ilhan Omar's office and make her swear on the Bible.
Yeah.
And you're now, using...
Listen, unless you're using, can enforce it by whipping out her Jewish space laser, I just feel like...
It's like you're using the Bible as a weapon.
Yeah.
And I have such an issue with that because the Bible is not meant to be used as a weapon unless God's using it to convict our hearts. To say, like, I'm coming at you. You know, Holy Spirit is, you know, like the, you know, it says the Word of God is living and active, sharper than any double-edged sword.
Yeah.
In Hebrews. And I get that. You know, that's God's way of, you know, convicting us and you know, making us see the truth of Him, who He is, who we are, our separation from Him, and how we need Jesus. You know, we shouldn't use it as a weapon.
Yeah.
Like going into somebody's office and saying, no, you're not a real congresswoman because you didn't swear on the Bible, so here's the Bible, put right, your right. hand on it, swear on it right now. And it's like, that's not God-honoring. Yeah. That's not what Jesus did. Jesus didn't walk around with a scroll and say, swear upon this scroll, or else you're not a real, you know, you're not a real religious leader. You're not a real Pharisee if you can't swear upon the scroll of Isaiah.
That's a bad Monty Python sketch waiting to happen.
I know.
Swear upon the scroll!
Swear upon the scroll! So
I guess my question then is this, because this was, you know, my friend's topic was... basically, you know, take the sentence and just cut it in half. Love the sinner. And stop right there. Don't add anything else onto it. Which I actually agree with. I think that if we're going to be the most... I think if we're going to be closest to following Jesus, I think that's probably our safest area to kind of hang in.
And I think that'll help not blur the lines.
Yeah, so. I do wonder, because his whole take on it was basically... it had to do with the fact he doesn't like the word hate. You know, someone was like, well, you know, God hates sin. You know, and we're supposed to, you know, kind of value the things that God values. And so if God hates sin, we should hate sin. And he's like, well, you know, I just don't like to bring hate into the equation. Which I think is an interesting kind of thought process. I think that's an interesting way to look at things, right? Like, how do we deal with that idea that God hates sin? I mean, Proverbs is very clear, right? God says multiple times, I hate, these are the things I despise, I loathe, right? Like, God's got some really, like, strong feelings on the subject. You know, and so I think that there's a lot of people who feel like that is a justification, almost like a green flag for them to also then hate these things. And he would basically say, well, you know, it's really not our place to hate. It's not even our place to hate those things. You know, my wife's take on it was that there is that separation of these are the things that cause someone pain and brokenness. And so when we see those things interacting and you know, impacting someone's life, especially someone we love, right? Like, it's hard not to be disgusted at that, yeah. Right? Like, you know, if you're... you know, if you have someone who you know, is dealing with cancer, especially if it's a you know, particularly malignant cancer, a more likely a fatal cancer, right? Like, no one's going to sit there and be like, oh, I'm kind of disappointed by cancer. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Right? Like, no one's going to... like, it's one of those things where it's like, no, it's I hate that stuff. I hate what it does to people. I hate what it does to people's bodies. I hate what it does to people's... lives. I hate what it does to people's families, right? And frankly, it's not like, you know, in most cases, it's not something that you choose to get. It's not like something that you're engaging in. It's just something that happens, in the brokenness of the world, right? So I feel like there is a little bit of a differentiation there where it's like, okay, you know, I can say I hate something in this way without making it a, you know, the fire and fury of a thousand suns has filled me, you know, and I pour it out on this one person or even on this one thing. Which may be the way God sees it.
Yeah, and I think we have...
But I don't necessarily feel like that's the way I see it. Like, when I use that term hate, I feel like that's the thing. I feel like when in his argument, you know, that his way of understanding hate was kind of like, it's this very harsh, personal kind of way of feeling or expressing that towards somebody, where I feel like, you know, there are things that I hate that have no personal context. Like, there's nothing attached to them except that it's matched which was my response, it's matched with a mourning. Yes. Right? Like, my hate is actually, it's almost like a sorrowful
yes.
kind of action, right? Like, I see that in you, and it saddens me. It breaks my heart for that person. It causes me to lament and to grieve on their behalf.
And I think that's how we should maybe approach, maybe we should, if we're going to still want to use that phrase, change it to...
Which I'm fine with not using yeah. that phrase ever again. I'm fine with that, not using
phrase, it too. But maybe we should say...
And I do use hate strongly yes. there. I hate that phrase.
Love the sinner, lament the sin.
Right. That was my take on
lament
it.
Lament is, and I think, you know, going back to that original phrase, love the sinner, hate the sin. The problem is we can't separate the sin from the sinner.
Here's my
We automatically hate the person.
But here's my question on it. You know, here's the kind of stuff that we get into, dear listeners, that we as pastors get to wrestle with theologically for you. Here's my actual question on this. You know, we are taught and trained, and we believe that God doesn't change,
yes.
right? That God stays the same, right? Like, it's one of those things that Scripture tells us, that God yeah. never changes, that God is the same today, you know, yesterday, today, and forever, that God's nature doesn't change. And yet, there is a part of me that wonders, does God's attitude towards sin, the way we read it maybe in the Old Testament, especially in the Proverbs some of the prophecies, when he gets into that, like, I hate and despise, does it change because of Jesus?
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the things we don't really find in the New Testament is that strong language of, I hate this.
Yeah.
And I'm and I'm not trying to be, like, you know, playing semantic games. It is one of those things where I do wonder if something... You know, in the way we understand some of that Old Testament language, if some of that changes because of Christ. Because I do feel like there's a sense of, you know, Jesus' parable was, you know, a farmer plants a field, and it grows both good stuff and some weeds, right? Like, there's crops and there's mm-hmm. and there's weeds. And, you know, the master's servants were like, hey, should we go start pulling the weeds? And he's like, no,
yep.
let them grow together and I'll deal with it in the end. Right? Which I feel is like a way more modern, Christ-like approach to people
yep.
and to even sin in some ways. Not that it's to be tolerated, not that it's acceptable, but it's almost like, let it endure, wait for the right time, because there's almost a different way I'm going to deal with this than maybe in the way I dealt with it yep. in the past. Does yeah. that make sense?
Yeah, because
I'm totally bouncing around. This is not something I'm trying to base any doctrinal like stance on. It's literally just one of those things where I'm kind of sitting there going, like, does Christ change the way God views or expresses emotion towards sin?
I think that I think one of the things that's kind of permeated the church for decades, long time, was this teaching that we are the messengers of Christ. But we are sent out as warriors for Jesus to conquer and win souls for the kingdom.
Yeah.
And the problem with that teaching is it puts all the onus on us. We are the ones. Like, I was talking to somebody I know, and she was going through, she was doing some, like, she was going, taking some courses in Bible college, right? And she was telling me that for their project, or for the one of her assignments for this class that she was taking on evangelism, was you had to witness and convert two people a week or something
mm-hmm,
like this
mm-hmm.
to, you know, for a grade.
Right. Nothing says get an A like bring some converts to Jesus.
And she was asking me about it because she was wondering my opinion. I was like, this is not right. Like, yeah. you can't put this kind of time period... And you can't put these parameters on witnessing and sharing the gospel. And you can't, it's not in your control to convert somebody, because if you, let's say you did,
yeah.
is that going to be a real conversion or not? You just may have persuaded them and they may just walk away eventually once like, it's like the parable of the seeds, right? Some is thrown on rocky soil, some is thrown in the weeds, some right. is thrown here. And I think that's one of those false teachings that has permeated the church, where we say like, oh, it's up to you. You need to start converting people. And I remember I grew up in this culture where it was almost like you had to wear this Christian belt around your waist and put notches in it.
Yeah.
To say,
yeah.
this is how many, because they, you would, I would be asked the question, how many people have you led to Jesus?
You know what always bothered me about the parable of the sower? especially like when I hear kind of like, you know, the way it was taught, or at least the way it was preached in my youth, in my upbringing, in my good Southern, mm-hmm. you know, evangelical charismatic group. And I have a hard time with this now.
Yep.
And I know part of it's like I'm getting old.
Yeah.
You know? And so you start viewing both things. I know, we're getting up there now. But there's a part of me where it's like, you know, the parable of the sower, like you just said, is the guy goes out and he sows and he throws seed, and some of it falls on thorny ground, some of it falls on thin ground, some of it falls on, what was the other one? I think there's, is it dry ground or something like that?
Yeah, and then there's some, you know, falls in the good
soil. There's like four different types of ground.
Yeah, the good soil is the best.
And the good soil, of course, is the best. It's the most important. It's the only one I was ever taught to care about.
Yeah.
And now I sit back and I'm like, I have a little garden.
Yeah.
I gotta be honest. Maybe it's just the compassionate part of my soul, which doesn't come out very often, I admit. Greg, I will admit. Like, you gotta delve for it sometimes. My compassion and empathy can sometimes show itself in really bizarre and unique places. Like, right now, I have a small fish tank.
Yeah.
It has one fish in it. You know what it's got? Snails. They're amazing. My COVID therapy snails, fantastic. They live about a year. That's about their general given time. Mm-hmm. And I have this one that I've had for about 9 or 10 months now. And he just finally had this little mini separation of his mantle that is pretty much what happens when they start to get old.
Yep.
Right? It is a $3 snail.
Yep.
But I have an entire quarantine set up for this little guy, trying to see if I can help him heal so I can get just those few more months out of what is probably the end of his life. Right? I have no interest. There's all these blogs about, like, listen, you know, sometimes you just got to do it, and you take them outside or you put them in the freezer and you just... And I'm like, I can't bring myself to do it. Yeah. You know? So it's like, I care very deeply about this stupid $3 snail. When I have a garden and I plant stuff, like, I want it to grow. And if it's not growing, it's like, I try to figure out why it's not growing, and do I need to try to shift it before it gets too embedded? Right? Like, there's a part of me that goes... And I get that part of it has to do with, you know, the sower of Jesus' day in his parable is probably doing a much greater plot and there's more return. But there's still this part of me that's like, why don't we care about the stuff that falls on ground that isn't good? And I feel like that, to me, is a hugely evangelical posture.
Yeah.
That we only care about this one type of soil, and the rest of the soil could just basically cuddle up and die. You know?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, it got some thorns, let it be strangled. Oh, it's on dry ground, let it choke to death. Oh, it's, you know, getting pecked by birds, whoopsie whoopsie.
Oh,
as long as we've got some good soil, that's all that matters. And I feel like there's this part of me that goes, I'm actually way more concerned about the stuff that didn't fall in the proper or most acceptable place. Like, I'm actually way more driven right now by that stuff that's actually in the weeds. And it's trying to make it, but it's going to have the hardest path.
It's because we don't like to go in the weeds.
Yeah.
We like to hang out in the good soil because that's our Christian bubble. We like to have our Christian bubble. We don't want to get out of our Christian bubble. So therefore, let's stay in the good soil. Forget the rest. Oh, you fell in the path and the birds are going to eat you. Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
Yeah. I feel like it's very... It feels incredibly uncompassionate and unempathetic, right? Like, I feel like Jesus's point was not don't care about the other soils.
No.
That was not the point.
Because Jesus said, if you had 100 sheep and one
passed
away, what do? You leave the 99 and go after the one.
Yeah. And again, Jesus is the one who, again, his later parable is hey, a farmer says, don't yank up the, you know, all this stuff just to get rid of a few weeds. Like there's this real sense of kind of like, I don't know, a connected care, a connected compassion for all of these various things that might be together. So I you know, I know we're running a little bit towards time on this one, but my question, I guess, as we wrap up on this, is this. If the phrase right now is love the sin, hate the sinner, and we both are not a big fan of that particular phrase, what would you fill in the blank for hate? If so, would it be lament?
I would say lament.
All right.
Because that pushes us towards the empathy and compassion.
I like it. I am playing around with the idea, and I don't know exactly how many Christian circles this might get me kicked out of. So before I release, like, you know, my next book on it or something.
Yes.
But what did strike me is I started going back, because like it was one of those conversations where it started making me go back and read through some of these parables, through some of Jesus' ways of just dealing with people, and through even some of the early, you know, kind of New Testament stuff. And I am I'm becoming a little convinced that our best actual word for it would be endure the sin.
Yeah.
Love the sinner and endure the sin.
That's a good one, too.
You know, the idea that endure encompasses both that sense of here are the things that break our heart when we see this. Here are the things that we mourn. Here are the things that actually annoy the heck out of us. Here are the things that we challenge. Here are the things that we push back. But we endure it because at the end of the day, we're way more concerned about the life that could happen than about rooting up all the bad stuff that might also just... Yeah. I don't know. That's one of the ones where I'm kind of playing around with, but...
Yeah, I agree.
I'll ask Kenneth Copeland.
Yeah, go ask Kenny.
I'll ask Kenny. I'll be like, hey, Kenny, when you're getting your vaccine, can you also tell me, how do you endure the sin?
Or maybe we could ask Paula White and say, can you call some African angels?
I need some endurance. I need some angel endurance.
Because apparently they have a lot of it.
Yeah, one of those.
They can fly all the way from Africa over here.
Like I said, this may not have been the most humorous or uplifting episode. But it addresses some stuff that's out there, and it gets us some thinking. But that's where I'm thinking is right now. I'm trying to figure out, like, what does it mean to endure if we had to endure? Because I feel like that's where God is at right now, right? Yeah. Like, look at us, as if we're perfect. Yeah, as if we've got our nonsense all together. We have literally people within our churches trying to storm capitals and prophesy presidents back into presidencies. And I don't even know those words. But anyway... You know, I just feel like there's enough nonsense going wrong that if anybody's going to get into hate the sin, we should really start ducking because it's probably going to be us that are on the recipient end of that.
Yeah.
In which case, I feel like God's compassion, right? The scriptures speak way more about God's compassion and his steadfast love and his grace and his mercy than they do about his hatred of a few lists of things. And so I feel like God is actually way more structured. His nature is way more to endure that period, endure people's walking away, to endure our fallenness and endure our growth, and then at that last day, find a way to redeem it.
Yeah, and I, I'll end with this. All the promises that God made, the covenants, we're going through a series in our church called Promises, and so it's focused on the covenants. And all the covenants, maybe not all of them, but a lot of them, if you notice, God is the one who makes himself out to be the keeper of the covenant. He keeps every... Because let's talk about the rainbow, right? Some interpreters have seen the rainbow. Like, why is it a sign? Why is that the sign? Because when God poured out his wrath in the flood,
right,
the rainbow was pointed the opposite direction. It was the bow... The bow shaft, and he's shooting the arrow at the earth. But when it was all done, he set his weapon down so that the arrow is pointing back at him. And he said,
"I've not heard that before.
I haven't heard it either." And then when you look at Abraham, when God made those promises to Abraham before he was called Abraham, he's called Abram.
Yeah,
and he said, "Here's what you need to do," because Abram was getting a little concerned about, like, "Well, I don't have an heir. What's going on?" He's like, "Here's what we're going to do. I want you to take some animals. I want you to cut them in half and put them on each side of this path."
Right.
And because when kings would make, and nations would make covenants back then, they would cut animals in half, and each party would walk through as a way of saying, if we break this covenant, may the same thing be done to us.
Okay.
Well, what did God do? He put Abraham to sleep, and God passed through.
Yeah.
Because he's saying, you're not keeping this, I will.
Yeah.
And so I think we need to keep that in mind. It's God saying, I'm not all about pouring out wrath on you. I'm all about compassion and mercy.
Yep. Well, and thus ends an episode. There's some things to think about, people. We gave you a lot.
Yes.
It'll be a good one. Well, until we see you next week, be good.
See ya.